This is a man's world, but it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
Hello, I'm Richard Adey. Welcome to Best Practice on RN Summer. One of the domains that is chockers with jargon is leadership. If you've listened to the program over the year, you'll know it's something we talk about a lot. And there are reasons for that. It's enormously interesting, for one, and it's very important because leadership is an industry. Think about it. It's at the heart of the offer of every business school. It drives book sales and seminars and TED Talks around the world. Jeffrey Pfeffer is Professor of Organizational Behavior in the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University, and he's been putting leadership under the microscope in his book, Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers One Truth at a Time. Let's begin with what the industry is worth.
It is a tremendous amount. McKinsey estimates $14 billion a year just in the U.S. Barbara Kellerman, a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, estimates $50 billion a year. Using data from the American Society for Training and Development, ASTD, I estimate $20 billion a year. And that, again, would be just in the U.S.
In spite of all that money, you do not feel that we're getting good value, do you?
The data suggests that the workplaces and leaders' careers are a mess, and companies themselves don't feel that leadership development is working very well. So if you look at Gallup or virtually any of the human resource consulting firms, their surveys of around the world of employee engagement find that employees are, for the most part, disengaged. Some of them are actively disengaged. Levels of job satisfaction are low. Trust in leaders is low. A Parade magazine survey in 2012 suggested that 35% of people in the U.S. would gladly forego a substantial raise if they could fire their direct supervisor. Leader tenure is going down. Many leaders are flaming out in their careers. And when you ask companies themselves, how successful are your leadership development efforts? Some surveys say 7% say they're successful. Some surveys say 8% say they're successful. But the companies themselves believe that their leadership development efforts are failing.
That is such a bad story. And yet, we don't really hear that often.
That is completely correct. People want to talk about good news, and this is a large industry. So when I take on this large industry and tell people how badly they're doing, this is an industry that does not necessarily embrace that message. And so I have probably stirred up a hornet's nest, but I'm a tenured professor, and I believe my job is to tell the truth.
I'm glad you mentioned truth, because it is clear from reading your work that it's not just the leadership industry, but more widely, we are telling ourselves a series of untruths about leadership.
That's correct. I mean, I think people have confused what they would like the world to be and how they want leaders to be with what in fact exists. So we would like leaders to be modest, that's for sure. We would like leaders to tell the truth. We would like leaders to be servant leaders and take care of other human beings. I agree with all of those sentiments, but we have confused what we would like to be with what is. So we don't really look hard at who is successful and the qualities and the characteristics that have made them successful. So the leadership industry is mostly a series of fictional stories.
Unfortunately, and the phrase that you use is telling and memorable, a lot of the people we get as leaders are, quote, lying narcissists.
Yes, that is certainly right. All you have to do is look at the U.S. political campaign right now. And of course, people will say, well, politicians don't tell the truth. They're kind of congenital at that. But I don't think that is inevitable or whatever. And we tolerate it. We assume that, Donald Trump is going to tell stories about his net worth. He's going to tell stories about how many bankruptcies he's had and whether they were personal bankruptcies or not. And none of this has any factual basis, and nobody seems to care. And by the way, this is true in the corporate domain as well.
Yeah, and in a way it's worse, because it really affects your life. If you're going to work and you're getting this spiel from the people at the top all the time, and yet you know the lived reality is quite different, there is enormous tension and stress on you.
And people, I think, become cynical, but it's worse than that. Some people go into work and they hear these stories and they believe them, and then they lose their job. So to take a simple example, a woman, a former student of mine, called me one day on the phone, almost in tears. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, well, you know, I went to work for this company and they said they wanted to improve their operations. And so therefore, everybody should be honest and open with their bosses and give them honest feedback. And she had a boss who happened to be also a woman. And she said, I told my boss, you know, what her flaws and faults were. And of course, now I'm headed for the door. And I said, why did you believe that you were supposed to give open and honest feedback? And of course, she said, because that's what we were trained to do in business school. And that's the values that the company espoused. I mean, cynicism is bad enough. But when you lose your job because you believe the stuff that you're told, then I think you're really in trouble.
So if we start with the business school, should they be teaching be narcissistic, lie if you want to have this career, or should they be teaching what they teach at the moment, which turns out to be completely wrong when you're in the workplace?
Well, my position on this is that if you want to get from where we are and the qualities that have made leaders successful to the world that I think many people would aspire to, you need to understand, first of all, where you want to go, but you also need to understand where you are and why you are where you are and the barriers that are going to keep you from going from A to B. So when we say we don't want people who are narcissistic, what you need to then do is look at what does the research literature suggest about the effects of narcissism on career success. And the literature is quite striking and quite consistent on this point. It suggests that narcissism is positively correlated for getting a job, that narcissism is positively correlated with getting raises and promotions in that job, that narcissism is, in fact, positively correlated with career success, even in the military. So if we say we don't want narcissists, then we need to ask ourselves the question, why are we selecting for narcissists? What are the processes that are making narcissists rise to the top, and how might we change those processes?
But if it's as stark as you say, and I'm sure you're right, that there's a correlation between narcissism and career success, then what we're talking about is the gap between what we would like human nature to be and what it is.
And it's not only a gap between what we would like human nature to be, but it's also a gap between how we would like our organizational processes to be and what they actually are. There's no law that says that narcissists have to be successful in their careers, but we respond well to people who stand out. We respond actually well to people who exhibit even unwarranted self-confidence. We respond well to people who are sometimes in error but never in doubt, and who look like they're going to win, and who look like they're powerful and project this aura of confidence and power. But that's not inevitable. So some years ago, symphony orchestras were very concerned by the fact that they had relatively few women, and they decided to try to do blind auditions, where the person would play the instrument for which the position was open, but they would play it behind a screen so you couldn't see their gender. And it turns out that solved the problem, and now a much higher percentage of women are getting hired into symphony orchestras all over the world. There was a bias. It was recognized. People accepted the bias for what it was, and then they found a workaround. You can do this with many of the domains of leadership that where we don't want. But until we recognize what is in fact currently associated with success and why, we will never make the changes like the symphony orchestras did that change things.
One of the things that you've written and spoken about is the incredible job loss that we see among leaders. And it doesn't help, even if you get a leader in who comes in wanting to improve things, if they're out in maybe 3 years.
That is certainly correct. I mean, as Machiavelli said more than 500 years ago, the first job of a leader is to keep his or her position, because you're not going to be able to use Stanford's Business School's tagline to change lives, change organizations, and change the world unless you have a position from which you can accomplish that.
The trouble is, of course, that there are conflicting pressures, especially in most people work in the private sector. So the board wants quarterly and half-yearly profits to go up and up and up. You might want to re-engineer the culture. You might have all these people who are incredibly disengaged. I think it's nearly a quarter of people have actively disengaged, which means that they would actually try and sabotage their own workplace. And these pressures, none of them go in the same direction.
None of those pressures grow in the same direction, and nor do the pressures to be individually successful versus organizationally successful. So I think one of the things that people need to understand is that there's a relatively small relationship between your success and your company's success. People say, you know, what do I need to do to be a more successful leader? And I say, what do you mean by successful? So you can take Stan O'Neill, who was the CEO of Merrill Lynch when Merrill Lynch did not survive the financial crisis and was driven into the arms of Bank of America. Stan O'Neill left with a severance package, I believe, of about $140 million. So was Stan O'Neill successful? It depends upon whether you're Mr. and Mrs. O'Neill or whether you're one of the Merrill Lynch employees who got laid off. And that's not untypical at all. I mean, Marissa Mayer, who's probably about on her last legs at Yahoo, got an enormous bonus to come in, has made a lot of money, will leave with a lot of money. So the idea that the company or the institution has to be successful for you to be individually successful just doesn't hold. And so you need to be, I think, much more focused on when you say successful or a good leader, what is the specific criteria that you are thinking about.
So how do we do that? Because the ways that have been tried, which is linking the stock market performance of businesses to the pay of the chief executive, have failed. In fact, what we now have is a management class that always does well, no matter what.
One of the solutions is you ought to tie leader evaluations to measures that you think you're working on and that are substantively important. There was a time when Hewlett-Packard, these are the days long before Carly Fiorina or Meg Whitman arrived on the scene, in which if you did not do well on your employee surveys as a leader at Hewlett-Packard, your career would be limited. So if we're serious about employee engagement, we ought to measure employee engagement and hold leaders accountable for that. If we're serious about increasing trust in leaders, we ought to measure trust in leaders as the Edelman Trust Index does and hold leaders accountable for that in their own organization. But most leadership development activities are measured now by these goofy happy sheets or smiley face sheets, which ask people, did you enjoy the experience? So we are rewarding entertainment and we're getting great entertainment. But that's, I think, a fundamental problem in the leadership development domain.
So what we're not doing is bringing in enough evidence-based practice, incorporating the research, the social science research that underpins it, and actually using it.
That is completely correct. Having just given a talk to a group of HR executives, I can tell you they are not only not bringing in evidence-based practice, they run away from the evidence. They run towards anecdote and inspiration, none of which provides any substantive basis on which to make effective changes.
But inspiration, I'm really glad you mentioned it, Jeffrey, because it's sort of a bete noire for you. You point out that we see it again and again. We see it all through leadership literature. We see it on the websites of business schools around the world. It's like everybody's looking for this magic quality, and yet, well, there's not really much evidence that it's what we need.
No, there's no evidence at all. Well, first of all, the inspiration often comes from stories that turn out on close inspection not to be true, which is another problem. But the other issue is that if you want to change people's behavior, we actually know how to do that quite well because we've built very effective programs for creating weight loss, for helping people lose alcohol and drug dependencies. And all of these programs recognize two or three fundamental behavioral truths. Number one, your behavior is affected by the behavior of those around you to whom you are socially connected. So you are much more likely to smoke and drink if you're surrounded by smokers and drinkers. So one of the first things an organization like Alcoholics Anonymous will do is say, get rid of your friends who drink. The second thing that we know quite well is that we are influenced by the cues in our environment. So Brian Wansink, a famous marketing professor, has written all kinds of books about losing weight. And one of the things that he has found is that if you serve people food on a bigger plate, they eat more. So one of the first things you want to do is you want to cue people's environments by giving them visual cues that help encourage the behavior that you want to encourage. None of this is around inspiration. This is around changing the informational and social environment that people face, which is, of course, what we know from decades of research is what determines their behavior.
So do we have examples, Jeffrey, of workplaces or businesses that have actually developed a culture that develops good leaders, the ones we say we want rather than the ones that are all about, you know, narcissism and heroicism?
Yes, there are some. I mean, SAS Institute, which is the largest privately owned software company in the world, headquartered in Cary, North Carolina. I still remember decades ago when I first interviewed Jim Goodnight, this founder and CEO, and he said to me, he said, "You come from the Silicon Valley." I said, "Yes." He said, "You guys are out there with the turnover rates of 20% and 30%. I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you know what we call a manager with who has a turnover rate of 20% or 30%? I said, "What?" He said, "An ex-employee." I mean, SAS has been serious about the idea that human beings and human resources are their most important asset, that the assets of the company and the value of the company walks out of the door every night, and that they want them to come back the next day. And they have taken the development of a strong, positive organizational culture extremely seriously and have done very well as a result. And SAS is typically on the best place to work list. Google is another place. Laszlo Bock, the head of operations, has written a fabulous book about how Google manages their people. They are extremely evidence-based. They are extremely worried about the attraction of the right people, the retention of the right people, and the development of people. But that they are exceptions. It would be nice if there were thousands of examples like this. There are relatively few.
Jeffrey, it has been fascinating. Thank you very much for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Professor Jeffrey Pfeffer is the author of Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers One Truth at a Time.